Good morning. Last day of the conference, everyone's ready to get home. I'm going to talk about database storage, buying database storage. I've done this presentation a lot of times before. I keep kind of vaguely changing it somewhat, but the rules don't really change that much over time about what you need to do. And everyone says, oh, now it's so much faster. I can go with RAID 5 now. Well, no, you can't. And I'll tell you why. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that people make the right decision. Lots of people go out there and they buy a ton of CPU hardware when they buy systems. But if you can never get to that CPU, it's just a waste of money. You have to be able to drive the CPU. The way to be able to drive the CPU is to make sure that you don't have a bottleneck on the disk side, the network side, or the memory side. So you have a whole bunch of things that you have to get through before you get to CPU. But a lot of people go out there and they go, oh, we've got this really fast machine. Great, you just can't use it. What we're gonna try to do today is buy the proper hardware to be able to drive that CPU investment as well as we can. So we're gonna talk about why database storage is so important, and it's kind of because it works in it tries to do two things, which are kind of opposed to each other. It's actually more than two things. But you're trying to store securely data, and you're trying to serve it fast. Well, those two don't always work together, because if I want to store it securely, I want to make more than one copy of it. That costs me more time. So I need to make sure that we do the right thing there. What do we do on the open edge side to take advantage of this new hardware that's out there? What is RAID? Well, and we still talk about RAID now, even though these disk arrays that we're buying have a huge amount of cache in front of them. But I'll show you a calculation that kind of allowed me to better understand what the benefit of going to RAID 10 over RAID 5 is, but also give a better explanation of exactly what those things are. Hardware versus software RAID. There's not a lot of software RAID out there anymore. Hardware RAID is so cheap to do now. You can go out and buy a Dell server, an Ecologic board, and then you've got a beautiful hardware-based RAID out there, and it works much better. And it doesn't eat up any of your CPU. And then we'll talk about how you're buying disk capacity, because you're buying multiple things when you buy disks. You're buying storage capacity and throughput capacity, and they're two different things. And then we'll talk about hardware options, and we'll wrap up. This is about me. I kind of wear two hats. I'm the president of White Star Software. We do training, consulting, and then we also have a managed database service called DB Appraise, where people can outsource as much of the DBA function as they want, and they know that they're going to have people on the other side who actually know what they're talking about. Why is storage so important? Well, you're trying to do three things. You're trying to get reliable storage. So I want to go out there and buy the best, most reliable storage I can. I need it to be available all the time. So the important thing to look at when you're buying things is things that can be changed on the fly, things that can be managed on the fly. If a disk goes down, I don't want to have to shut down the array to put a new disk in. I just want to shove a new one in. And we had, the other day, we had a power supply go out. And I have three power supplies on our machine. So I should have had two power supplies and my machine still running. But the operating system tried to be helpful. So it saw that my power supply went out and says, hey, you got a power supply out, and shut down my machine. I said, I still have two good ones. So I just pulled the power supply out. Now I have two good ones. So sometimes the operating system works against you, or some other part of it works against you. And then we talk about the performance of this. Because I can buy huge drives now, multi-terabyte drives. If I go out and put a multi-terabyte database on a multi-terabyte drive, my performance is going to be absolutely horrible. That means I have plenty of storage capacity, but I don't have very much throughput capacity, because it's only one drive, possibly a spinning drive. And we're learning more and more, or we're going more and more, to solid state. And solid state's being purchased because it's becoming cheap enough to do it. And a lot of the larger array manufacturers do tiered, what they call tiered storage. And the tiered storage is where you have a tier of solid state, another tier of fiber channel drives, and then another tier of SATA drives. And the reason they do that is because if you want to have all of your stuff on solid state, it would cost you a fortune. So what you need to do is they move, in theory, dynamically, your data to the correct tier based on the amount of access that you do. You can do this by hand. You can say, I'm going to put my historical stuff on slower drives. I'm going to put them on the drives that I allocate last. Or you can have some function do it automatically for you, or like with an EMC VMAX or HP EVA. They don't really do it tiered, but they flatten out your I/O load across all the disks that are in the array. So why is it so important? Everything starts on the disk. If you can't get it off the disk to begin with, then you're never going to be able to see it and use it. It's the second most likely cause. Applications always the first most likely cause. I can't make bad applications good. I can make them consistently bad, but I can't make them good. And there's even consistently bad is better than bad, because then people can at least rely on the response time they're going to get. It's not going to go up and down. So what you want to do is, consistency is one of the things that you're tuning for over time. You're trying to get it to be consistent. And then hopefully, once you have it consistent, if you have something that's consistently bad, you can correct the application and make it good. Okay, but when we're tuning, we're looking at things that go from orders of magnitude. So I'm pushing stuff from the network to disk. That's an order of magnitude faster. I move something from the disk to memory. That's an order of magnitude faster. So I'm going from milliseconds to nanoseconds. So that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to push the resources all the way up there. That's why it's so good for people who are doing using large temp tables. When they use the BT option, they've saved themselves potentially a network I/O if they have their temp files on a network drive. But they've also saved themselves even going to disk at all by going into memory. So they've leapt two orders of magnitude. And I've seen places where temporary file I/O is 25% or more of the total I/O on the system. And everyone here who has MFG Pro, you should be listening very well right now, because MFG Pro is one of the people who have this issue, where it's a huge amount of your I/O, and spreading that out is as important or more important than spreading out your database I/O. Okay, so what we're trying to do is push things faster: the network to the disk to the memory, memory to CPU. Okay, with OpenEdge, how many people here aren't running Type 2 storage areas?
A few.
So we have a few databases, and usually the databases that aren't running Type 2 areas are the ones that you most want to run Type 2 storage areas, because they're very large databases. And the cost of going to a Type 2 storage area, of having to dump and reload, is generally high or prohibitive for some people. There are tools that can make it very, very quick. BravePoint has a tool out there that works very well for this. But there's also strategies that you can do that don't involve buying a tool that can allow you to get to this Type 2 storage area very, very quickly. Database block size is also something that we want everybody to tune. The default of 1K is universally bad. It works on nobody's system the best. It's historical in its nature. So what we want is the default on Windows now is 4K, and that's good, because Windows is basically hardwired to move things in 4K chunks. And so we want to do things the way that the operating system wants to work. People say, well, how about if I use an 8K block size on Windows? Well, that's okay too, because it's a multiple of the block size. And the performance is going to be reasonable. I haven't seen a dramatic difference in performance between an 8K block size and a 4K block size. But when you adjust these records, when you adjust the block size, you have to adjust the records per block. We'll talk about the BI cluster size a little bit later and about Afterimage.io. Type 1 records. All of the records are social. So like if you look at your default storage area, that's a type 1 storage area. Generally, it's very good for very, very small records, people who have one row, like a control file or something like that. Those could go into those areas and work well. Everything else should be in a type 2 storage area. And the type 2 storage areas, the benefit that you get is you move from your data being interleaved like this to your data being clustered. And the data being clustered is I have like data sitting right next to each other, regardless of how many objects I have put into that particular storage area. So if I have a storage area that contains 4 different tables and its indexes, I'm still clustering that data. And the minimum I'm gonna get is whatever the cluster size is. So if I have an 8K block and I have 512K cluster, well, I'm gonna get 512 8K blocks right next to each other. The benefit is all of these disk arrays that we're buying today have something called predictive read ahead. And it sounds really smart. It sounds like these guys are doing a really good job. What they're really doing is they're just reading a couple blocks ahead of you and putting that up into the cache of the array in hopes that you're going to read that. Well, if you have your things clustered, it's very likely that you will read ahead and you will get that cache hit rate. And that means that you're going to go from disk speed to memory speed, because you're going to go from doing a physical I/O to doing a cache hit on the array. So that's much, much better. So we found that clustering universally improves performance. We have not found a case scenario that clustering does not improve performance. And someone's going to come up with one someday, but no one's done it yet. And the theory is that if I had a whole bunch of records and I was doing a whole bunch of random I/O and I wasn't necessarily doing it all sequential and I wasn't doing reads that we do lots of during the day, I could actually punish performance by going to large clustered data. But we've not found that. Every time we've done it, even with very, very tight, high update applications, clustering beats not clustering all the time. And I think part of this, it's kind of twofold. When I go out there and insert my first row into a table, it goes out there and grabs me a whole cluster full of blocks for that table. Then I never have to go get another block for that thing until I've gone out there and created 4 meg worth of stuff, if it's 8K versus 512. So I can really reduce the amount of time that I need to do, and I eliminate a number of times that I'm increasing the size of the database. So that's really the benefit of this type 2 storage area, or one of the benefits, as well as that predictive read ahead. The data is clustered together. You only have single table or single indexes. Indexes have always been antisocial. They don't want to have anybody else's index information in a block with them. But now you not only have the data isolated to a block, you have the block isolated to a cluster. So now I have lots of index information. And when I do that index read that I hope everyone's doing in their application, now I can go in there and I'm getting predictive read ahead working for me. I'm getting all this stuff. So I'm getting other benefits out there. So doing that is great. It's base 8. So the minimum number of blocks per cluster can be 8 if you go to type 2. Tom and I have been politicking for a while to get a 1-block cluster. And the reason to get a 1-block cluster is because there's a benefit in just the fact that it's clustered. And the reason is things like index rebuild, which you shouldn't be doing a lot, but things like index rebuild, when I want to go out and delete all of the index blocks for a table, I have to update 1 block, and all I have to change is 1 byte. I have to say, this is a free block. It's no longer an index block. If I move the first one, the rest of them are all chained together, so they're all going. So it's 1 change to get everything moved over there, so it's much more efficient. So even a 1-block cluster would be a good thing to have. So we're trying to reduce data scatter. If you've had a problem with data scatter in the past, these creating things with big cluster sizes tend to really reduce your scatter over time. And scatter The bad thing about scatter is that your data, now when I go and get blocks, they're going to be all over the place, and I'm not going to be getting high value reads. And I want my read value to be much higher. When I go and do a physical IO, I don't want to get one block, or I don't want to get one row. I want to get a few rows, and I want to also promote a few rows that I'll probably need up into the cache. So those are the things that we want to do. And visibly, it just looks like this, where I have customers, and there'll be a cluster of data there. Then I'll have order line. I could have index information there as well. And just to look at it at the block by block level, here you'd see type one, where you'd have data block, index block. They'd all be interleaved. In type two, you'd have all those data blocks and then index blocks of whatever index was in there. So people say, well, how about if I just have one table in that, should I still have type two? And the answer is yes, absolutely. It's going to be naturally together. But the benefit that I talked about having a one block cluster still holds true for all this other stuff that these guys have. So every table that you have, even if it's isolated one table to an area, you still want to use type two. So it's universally better. Database block size. You want the database to be using the OS block size or a multiple of that. So you want it to be a multiple of that. If you're using a 1K database block size and the read size for your operating system is 4K, what's going to happen is you're going to get a 4K read with 3K of it that you don't need. So you're not going to get high value reads out there. You possibly will get some read ahead that you didn't expect, but it's still well inefficient to do. So we want to get the database block size to use 8K for every platform except Windows, where we want it to be 4K. And really, if you used 8K for every platform, you'd still probably be right. You wouldn't be wrong. So we want to match or be a multiple of those, and larger blocks. Once I go from 1K of blocks to a higher number of blocks, I may have to increase the number of records per block. The records per block out there are 64, so that means that you have to have 8K divided by 64. That's how much space you have to have. And I have a little calculation here of figuring this out, where it says calculation is database block size divided by the mean record size. So where do I get that mean record size from? DB analysis. If you do a DB analysis out there, one of the things that you have is mean record size. The mean is a better thing to use than average, but also you need to look at how much standard deviation there is inside there. So if you have a lot of standard deviation, you need to know if you have a lot of very, very small rows and a lot of very, very large rows. And the mean record might have been a large row or it might have been a small row. That might not be the thing. So you need to look at that, and going higher is generally less painful than going too low. So having a too high number is generally a better option than having a too low number. The only exception to that rule is on tables that have billions of rows. Then you can run out of record IDs. Probably not now in the 64-bit version of Progress, but in 32-bit, I had clients that ran out of record IDs with the 32-bit record IDs. So here's what you do. You have to choose a binary number between 1 and 256, so 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. And I take that calculation, and if you look, my mean record size is 90. I have 20 bytes for overhead. The 20 bytes for overhead is the block overhead, the area overhead, all that stuff, and it's just aggregated. And we've tried to figure out if it's any different number in all these different versions of Progress, and it hasn't really changed. It's about 20. So you get 110, divide that, you get 74. Well, here, I would choose the next higher binary number, and I would choose 128. I wouldn't choose 64. The reason I wouldn't choose 64 is because I would get to 64 records stored, and then I'd be out of slots. And I'd still have room for more rows. So I really want there to be more slots available to me so I can get all 74 rows in there. So the BI cluster size, this is probably the largest component of update speed that you have out there. This is one of the things that you can drastically increase the amount of update that you can do to the database per unit of time. And the reason is because this dictates how frequently you do checkpoints. And a checkpoint is a point where memory and disk are coalesced. So when I go out there and I look and those things have been put together out there, it's a very painful event because I have to do a lot of things at cost, like do writes. But if I've gone out there and my BI cluster size is larger and I have APWs out there writing all that modified data out to the disk, my hope is that if I give it enough time, every checkpoint I do will be what I call a cheap checkpoint or a free checkpoint. And that means I go there and there's nothing in the to-be-written queue. All of that stuff's been synced down. So the only job it has to do is tell all the current buffers, okay, now you're on the list to be written before the next checkpoint. But that's a very cheap operation because that's all done in memory. If there's anything on the to-be-written, if there's anything to be done on the to-be-written queue, that has to be flushed prior to anyone moving forward. Any updater on the system cannot move forward until that stuff gets synced to disk. And this used to be what we called the pregnant pause problem, where the system's galloping along very fast and it stops. And then it gallops along very fast and then it stops. And that was stopping every time it was doing a checkpoint. Yes?
Does the larger BI size also apply to the work group where you go around and do it with page writers?
That's an excellent point. Does this apply to work group? And the answer is, kind of. Okay? You don't have APWs. So you wouldn't want to go out there and make it huge. But the default to 512 is probably still too small, and you wouldn't notice a write of maybe 2 meg or 4 meg. I wouldn't make it galactically big, but generally a work group you're saying, I'm not doing that, but I only have a few people, I'm not doing that much anyway. So I'm looking at this when I look at my peak update period of the day, where my humans are on the system, not necessarily my MRP run or something where I did a mass update. But when people are on the system and they would notice the fact that it was pausing, I want to make sure that I don't do a checkpoint more frequently than every 120 seconds. And some people can never get there. We did a benchmark where we were writing a gig of information every 30 seconds. So I was never able to actually get ahead of it. But we had so much stuff in cache and so much hardware behind it, it didn't really matter. But in most people's cases, they'll be able to jump ahead and have that ability. So 120 seconds is really just a number we chose. And it's the best number we know of now because it generally that gives it the APWs enough time to synchronize all the data to disk before you hit the next checkpoint. After imaging. Everyone should be using after imaging. Is everyone using after imaging? How many people are not using after imaging? Okay, every person who really likes data and really wants data integrity should have after imaging because it provides you a level of protection that nothing else provides. I can mirror my disks. I don't get the level of protection with after imaging. I can do all of this stuff. People say, oh, I have replication. I have all this other stuff out there. I have hardware replication, but they don't have after imaging. If someone goes out and updates every last name to Smith and I have data mirroring, well, everybody's last name is going to be Smith on 2 copies of it. But if I have after imaging, I can get my last backup and I can roll forward to a point in time just before they updated everybody's last name to Smith, and then I'm up and running and I've lost the least amount of data as possible. And that amount of data could be very significant if your backup is once a day. You know, it could be 23 hours, 59 minutes that you have a backup for. So you really need to make sure the only way you protect that intra-backup data is by having after imaging. All I want you to do when you think about after imaging is I want you to isolate it as much as possible. It's impossible if you have something like an HP EVA because all of the data is interleaved across all of the disks. It's not possible for you to set it separately. But you can give it another lung. So another logical unit that you carve out of that disk array. That will protect you from a lot of different things. You can have it in a different file system. So you protect yourself from the, oh shoot, I just hit RM minus R. Hopefully you didn't do it from slash. I've seen that one before too. So usually those are automated too. I like those ones when they automate the RF, they say, and they have a variable that they put in there and it's slash, then the variable name, and they forget to fill the variable. Works really well. Automated delete your whole system.
Have you been to my shop? We just fixed that problem 6 months ago.
Yeah, well, it's not uncommon. It's really, really not uncommon. And it's crazy. It's just you say, okay, well, have these people ever thought about test environment?
No.
So the rights to this particular file are expensive. They're sequential. They're dead sequential. They're just going to write. You don't reuse space. You don't read much from it unless you're doing replication. Replication does read from the AI file to use those notes to apply to your replication database. So that, I don't really worry about it per se, as the only thing I worry about is it's got to be separate. It's got to be separate from the BI file, and it's got to be separate from the DB file. It can be with your temp files, it can be with anything else, but it can't be with the DB or BI. And the farther it can be, the better. RAID. Okay, we have striping, mirroring, we'll talk about RAID 5, and I didn't know any other way to put controversial, because everyone says, oh, it works great on my system. And it does until it doesn't. The problem is that it does until you actually need to do something in a hurry. And that's when it fails, and I'll show you why that fails. And then there's RAID 10 or 0+1, which is really what Progress wants you to use for everything. The only thing you might not put on there is temporary file I/O. You might put that on striping because you can get a wider spread for cheaper money. And the cost of losing it would just mean I'd have to reset my dash T option. But so striping is where I say, I've got three disks out here. Stripe 1's on disk 1, stripe 2's on disk 2, stripe 3's on disk 3, and then stripe 4 goes back over to disk 1. The thing we want to think about on all striping, either this kind of striping or RAID 10 striping, is we want to use the widest stripes we can. We've done testing, and the default stripe width for most manufacturers is very, very small. Very small. Like 16K. We'd like you to use stripe widths of like 2 meg. So it's a lot bigger. So this, if you're doing striping either at the OS level or you're doing striping at the array level, you want to make sure that your stripe width or chunk size is big. And the reason that you want it big is because that predictive read ahead, because the things that you're reading, you want to read sequentially. You don't want to be jumping around for those. So using larger stripes improves performance. And we've seen a linear increase in performance as the stripe width has increased. Okay. Striping is great. It's great for I/O performance because I've got the most amount of disks that can feed me data at the same time. Every spinning disk can do 150 I/Os a second, 100 to 150 operations per second. That's it. So if I have to do 1,000 operations out there, I know that I need about 10 disks. So I need to make sure that I have enough disks to be able to push that out. If I only have 10 disks, then striping might be my only option. But you have higher ability to fail in this case, because if any one of those disks, any one of those three disks in the previous slide failed, everything fails, because I'm losing a random section of the file system. So I talked about the stripe width. This is the thing. This presentation and all the presentations will be out on the website for you to download. So you'll have look at this and just move to at least 128K. I think that's a good minimum. And then larger is better. When we have mirroring, I just have one disk, one parity. They work, and they're not really one disk, one parity anymore. It works as an active-active. And what you get is something called optimistic read. Optimistic read is I read from the closer disk. So if I have disk one has an address that's really high, the head's at a really high address, and disk two and parity one is at a low address, what'll happen is it'll just choose the one that's closer, and that will feed you the data. It gives you about a 20% increase in performance over a single disk. that optimization that they've done. So you know you don't get 150 IOs, you get that plus 20%, so you get 180 IOs per second, or 120, somewhere between 120 and 180 IOs per second per disk, per the forward disk, not the both. So this is great for reliability, because the disk fails, you just pull it out, pop a new one in, Bob's your uncle. Now, when we now if we have RAID 5, and I call this poor man's mirroring, because I can get the benefit of being in a mirror. And a lot of times you'll have five disks out there, you have four disks worth of storage. The storage capacity that you have is four disks of them, and then one disk for parity. But the problem with this is that you have to do three operations on every write operation you do. Fortunately, most applications do about 10% of write operations compared to read operations, usually even less. But every write operation, to be RAID 5 compliant, it has to go over one controller. So the single controller has to write the primary data, calculate the parity data, and then write the parity data. So that's three operations versus a single operation that would happen either with mirroring or on a single disk. If you had read-only applications, I would say that RAID 5 might be okay. But again, even read-only applications will have problems when you do bulk operations like you do a backup. And I never understood read-only applications anyway, because how'd the data get there in the first place? RAID 10. This costs twice as much for the storage capacity. I want to buy, you know, a given amount of storage capacity, I have to buy that disk, and I have to buy its pair. And I have to do that every time. I have to do it every time I upgrade. I don't upgrade by single disks anymore. And the disks, it's not the disks that cost you. Disks are nearly free. It's the shelf space that costs you. So buying the shelves are expensive. So what we want to do is overbuy shelf space when we buy the disk array to begin with, so when we do an upgrade, we have shelf space put it in. So I don't have to buy a shelf and the drives. So that's really important. This is really reliable. It's good for read and write applications, because you get that optimistic read, get closer disk. I also get a single write, and then the second write is done off the other controller. So you can have multiple controllers out there working at the same time. And this is the cache fill rate. Let me fill this in here. I've got four disks out here, and I'm just comparing what the performance would be and when I would run out of cache. Okay, I've got 4 gig of cache, which is a reasonable amount of cache out there for a small array. And I go out there, and right when I started doing that, I've got this database, and I can never fill it. So this is the thing that everyone tells me. My performance is fine, because they just run their application all day. And yes, it is fine. Now if I have some heavy production update in the middle of the night that I don't notice, that I might have to run during the day, well, if it runs for 43 minutes, I'm good. I haven't gone to conventional disk speed. But if it's RAID 5, I have 17 minutes before it's going to swap from using cache to cache every update to going down to conventional disk speed. That's not a lot of time. Everybody's got processes that run way longer than 17 minutes. If you look at the maintenance example, like an index rebuild or even a backup of your database, I back it up to another location on disk, you eat up that cache so quickly. You're talking about 4 minutes, and then you're down to conventional disk speed. That's why doing a backup can sometimes punish performance so bad, because you're close, and then you put that backup out there, you're backing up from disk to disk, and you've eaten up all the cache that you had that was helping you in the first place. So it's really, really important that you understand that RAID 5 is still bad, that it still has all these issues on maintenance operations, on restore operations, on things that are become time critical. So we want to make sure that we understand that up front. And if we say, hey, we think that doing a recovery is such an uncommon event, we're willing to take the extra time to do the restore, you're making an informed decision. Not the decision I would make, but at least it's informed. So I want to you know, encourage people to at least look at this and talk to the people when you're buying disc hardware and say, this is what we have going on, because everybody, every vendor says our RAID 5 is different. Well, unless they've changed physics sometime, then there is not any different. It's as fast as those spinning discs will go, or as fast as the flash will take the information in. Software RAID versus hardware RAID. Obviously, hardware RAID is the preferred solution. You're buying additional CPU capacity, additional memory capacity to deal with the I/O operations going to disk. Software RAID goes out there and uses the system resources. So you're using expensive system CPU, which is not optimized to do storage operations. It's a general purpose CPU. You're using that, and you're using the memory, which you're competing with yourself. You're competing with it for the user memory, the buffer pool, all the other things you want to use memory for. So software RAID, unless you have to do it, if you don't have any option to do mirroring and striping without that, you want to avoid that. And there used to be a problem on IBM, if they were running EMC hardware, you wouldn't want to run mirroring and striping on the EMC side. So what you do is you'd run mirroring on the EMC side, and then you'd stripe on the operating system side. And striping on the operating system side is very, very inexpensive because it doesn't have to do much aside from create a lot of logical pointers out there. So if you have to do one on one side, do the mirroring and heavy lifting on the hardware side, do the striping on the software side. When I buy disks, I want you to buy the smallest disks you can, and your vendor wants you to buy the largest disks you can, because a lot of vendors charge you per gig of storage. And if you buy a lot of big disks, they slide that in, that's a lot of gigs of storage right there. So what you want to do is you want to say, I don't want the largest disks you have, I want the smallest disks you have. And the reason you want the smallest disks is because every one of those things can only do 150 IOs per second, that's it. Or if it's flash, it's higher than that, but you still want to, even with flash, you still want to have multiple flash in there because you need to mirror all that stuff, especially on flash drives, because they're slightly less reliable. And that's just because of how they're sparing out the old memory, the old pieces of memory that don't work. I want to buy the fastest disks I can. Obviously, if you look at it, the hierarchy, you're going to say flash is going to be at the top, then you're going to want 15K SAS drives, those are going to be the second, then you're going to want 10K SAS drives, then SATA drives. And you can buy a lot of SAS drives cheap, and you'll get really good performance. But the idea is many hands make light work, so you want as many of those as you could possibly have. Additionally, what you want to do is, if I have a lot of disks out there, I could take the best part of the disk on the outer ring of the disk where I'm getting the best performance, and I can allocate that first. So I go out there and I allocate a bunch of file systems across all these disks. Those file systems are being used to store my most important, my most critical, most used data. And the reason is because I get 20% benefit in performance by using the outer portion of the disk than the inner portion of the disk. As you fill disks, they get slower and slower because you get less IOs per spin of the disk. So it just gets smaller and smaller. So if you have things that have been built over time and then your database system was one of the last things put on there, what happens is you got the worst part of the disk. So I like to put my historical information on the inner portions, and so I go out there and I create mine and I know, okay, I've got an A portion of the disk, I've got a B portion of the disk, and I have a C portion of the disk. And my A portions, I put all my mission critical stuff, my BI file, my AI file, and my critical tables. On the B portion of the disk, I take stuff that's kind of my tire kicker stuff that I go out and run reports on, that stuff that I need, and then historical stuff goes on C, or backups, or other stuff, they can go to C. Because I don't care if a backup takes me an extra 10 minutes, just doesn't matter. As long as I'm meeting my window, I don't care if a backup takes 10 hours. I don't care that. So what you want to do is when you're buying this array, you also want to leave yourself room for inexpensive growth. And that was the thing I was talking about with shelf space. I want to overbuy shelf space. So if you buy an array and it says, oh, we can take 4 trays on the purchase, buy the four trays and fill them halfway. Then you can buy discs and fill those afterwards for really cheap money. So as you grow, you'll be able to grow into that file system. So, but going out and having to add a shelf, a lot of times it's an outage to add a shelf. So that's an expensive operation. And the other thing is the cost of a shelf plus two discs. Well, the two discs they're in the rounding error, because the shelf is going to cost you a fortune, because that comes with power supplies and everything else. So it's and also all these manufacturers know they got you. Right when you start storing stuff there, the second you put data on their array, they got you. Because going someplace else is going to be expensive. So what we need to do is make sure we have vendors that we like. Okay? And this comes true. We want to find the disk arrays that we like. We want to find disk manufacturers that we like. So we're looking for reliability, because that's our first responsibility, making sure that the data is reliably stored and be able to be retrieved for a long time. Look for the features that you want. Remote mirroring. Some people like that. Oh, I want to mirror off to another site across a thin network. Look at your storage capacity. That's the amount of stuff you need to store total, backups and all that stuff added together. Throughput capacity is the amount of online fast stuff you're going to have coming in and out all the time. And that can be calculated when you're looking at ProTop or you're looking at Promon. You look at that and you say, how many read IOs am I doing per second? Not the logical IOs, but the physical IOs. So I look at the physical IOs and I look at physical IOs and physical writes, and then I can get a basic understanding of how much I'm doing. I look at that at the peak periods of the day. So if you look at a buffer hit rate, and I'll just give you one quick example with buffer hit rate. If I look at a buffer hit rate and somebody gets a 98% buffer hit rate, that means that 2 reads out of every 100 are coming from disk. That sounds really good. Well, I have clients that their machine would glow red if I had a 98% buffer hit rate. If I go from 98% to 99%, that's a 50% reduction in IO. Now I'm only doing one read operation for every 100 logical reads that I do. So I've saved 50% of my IO by going 1% higher on my buffer hit rate. And that number jumps again if I go to 99.5. So the higher I can push that buffer hit rate, the lower the number of disks that I have is. So you want to look at the things that are punishing you the most, the historical reads, which are going to punish you the most. Those are the ones that you have to be able to feed and get out through the disk itself. And you have to look at your buffer hit rate during that period to be able to get an accurate assessment of what I need to be able to supply throughput to my users in a timely fashion. So that's where we're looking for the throughput capacity to support that. And then my replacement upgrade path. Now every good manufacturer has an in-place upgrade path or a no downtime upgrade path where you can just move your stuff over to your new array, add your controllers in, and then swap over all hot. So you don't have to shut anything down, you don't have to do anything. That's anything that you're doing is that has enterprise level storage, you should have that. But if you're a small company, that doesn't mean you're out of luck. Equalogix sells incredibly capable array cards. And we have one in our server, and it just runs great all the time. We never have huge cache issues. We never have any of this. And it runs a lot of drives, and it's very, very efficient. So when you're at the low end, you're going to be looking maybe at an iSCSI solution that you can support to a lot of people. iSCSI should work fine as long as it has its own network fabric to go across of. And you don't want to share your network fabric with your user traffic. It's low cost, and the components of it are general availability. You can buy them anywhere and pop them in there. The medium to large scale, you're going to want to buy some SAN solution, so I can use it for this mission critical application and this mission critical application. But this makes the tuning of it much more difficult, because now I have to take into consideration the amount of IO load across systems. And we were doing this for a client. We had to make sure that, like, we looked at their accounting system, and Month End used to punish their system really, really bad. And then we looked at their other system, and they used to have a different period of the time day. So we could put those two on one array, and it was no big issue. They tried to do this. They did it the wrong way the first time, and this is how we figured it out, is that they had two things that had month end go off at the same time. Well, the month ends for everybody at the same time. So if they have a big month end process, well, so they put two of them on the same array, and the array used to just go to its knees. And even when one side wasn't doing month end, the other side could you know, the side that wasn't doing month end could feel the month end from the other people. So they were getting punished. So we had to make sure that those were balanced properly, that we had everybody getting their amount of storage capacity and throughput capacity throughout the month. So we were making sure that we didn't have high times for two applications at the same time on the same array, if possible. And then enterprise, that's going to be fiber, dual loop through the cabinet, nearly unlimited scalability. And I give you a few examples here of what we can do. The one thing I want to talk about specifically is network attached storage, specifically NetApp. If NetApp is really, really bad for progress, and it's really, really bad for all database applications, because it deals with things at a file by file basis, and progress does not deal with anything in a file-by-file basis. It deals with things that as a block basis. So you need to get a machine that does the same thing that you do. So I've seen, you know, people buy NetApp, and it's absolutely the kiss of death for performance. It might work in test, and they go, oh, it's fine. We did it in test. We had two users on there. It worked fine. Then they go out there, and they try to scale it to 1,000 users, and they say, why is this terrible? Well, it's terrible because it was terrible before. You just didn't know it. So it's just don't know. Okay, upgrade path. In-place upgrade or some convenient way. Some people have a way of doing it with software. Some people have to do it with hardware. You want to make sure that you have as close to zero downtime as possible. A lot of them are either zero downtime or you do a disk copy. You have to take a short outage to do a last disk snap, and then you start up on the new array. That's the worst case scenario on anything that's enterprise class, and even anything that's kind of mid-range class now. I mean, when you buy stuff. And I think of the best low, short range would be the Echologic. If I went to the mid-range, I'd think about maybe a VNX. That's a much lower cost solution. You can get into a VNXE for, you know, $15,000. I think the bottom of the line is about 10. But a VMAX, you're talking about six figures or seven figures. So it's a huge amount more to do that. But there's obviously capabilities that one has that the other doesn't. The storage capacity of that VNXE is still 252 terabytes. So it's a lot of storage capacity, but it doesn't have near the throughput capacity of something else. HP EVA, anybody who has a shop that doesn't have a dedicated disk administration person, I would say EVA is a really good choice. And the reason is because it's dead, dumb, stupid. You go out there, you set up the array, you say, I want everything to be in the same disk core. It goes, okay, fine. And then you just start carving out LUNs. It will spread your I/O load out for you. It'll get it all balanced for you across all the disks out there. And it just makes it super easy to use. If you're looking for the absolute highest performance that you can get out of something, Hitachi Data Systems, I think, is pretty much the undisputed leader in performance. But again, you're talking about huge investment in dollars. The only benefit of Hitachi is they'll allow you to buy capacity on demand. So you can buy, you get a huge machine delivered to your shop as long as you have fairly large capacity needs. But then as you need more space and more spindles and more throughput, you can just buy it and they'll just turn it on for you. So it's a pretty interesting way of doing it. IBM's got a whole bunch of storage that they've gone through, and they do make reasonable storage. It's not, but if I were choosing, it probably wouldn't be on the top three of my list. It would be on the bottom three, if I had six here. Fusion.io, and there's a whole bunch of these similar type vendors now. And these vendors are saying, I've got Flash, but I now have Flash and I have accelerated cache in front of it. I have a little disk array that's this big, and it's got 4 terabytes of storage, and then it's got 128 gigs of flash storage in front of it. And it runs incredibly fast. So when I do conversion for a lot of clients, I just plug that baby in and off I go. So I get a lot better performance off this little tiny machine that I have than a lot of people have on their big machines. And it's just because what I've done is I've purposely bought something and made it go as fast as it can go. And it gives pretty good performance. But those are the ones that you should look out there. There's a ton of other new vendors out there. And these new vendors, you just need to look at their reliability. You need to be able to talk. If you haven't heard the name before, you need to get references. You need to talk to those references, and you need to make sure those references aren't the guy's buddies. You know, because it's like, I've seen that happen before too. So, but generally, if I'm gonna buy name brand anything, it's gonna be name brand storage, because that's the most important thing. Even if I buy Dell, I can buy Equalogix from Dell and they'll support it. So I don't have to get a separate support contract for my Equalogix. I don't have to get that for the storage at all. So I can go out there, buy a Dell machine with a really nice Equalogix cabinet and just go. And I'm one vendor support. That I'm really like that. The only way I'd be willing to go to a different vendor support is if I needed a Hitachi for ultimate performance, or if I needed an EVA for simplicity. I'd be willing to do that. Points to remember, disks are the place that you should put your money. And I say this every year, and everyone goes, I'm still gonna buy more CPUs than I possibly need. But CPUs are way down the list. Take advantage by going to type 2 storage areas, using a larger block size, separating your stuff out, especially the AI file, and concern yourself with where those temporary file IO is going, because it's a real portion of the IO going to your system. You have to say, here's what I need, and here's my anticipated growth path for the next 3 years. Because every hardware purchase, at least in the United States, is a 3-year purchase minimum. Because that's how long accounting can write it off in. They can't write it off in anything less than 3 years, unless it's just a regular expense purchase versus a capital purchase. But any capital purchase gets written off in 3 years. And hardware manufacturers know this. If your cycle is 4 years, make sure you buy a support contract for all 4 years on year one. Because if you try to buy the 1-year support contract at year three, a new array can be cheaper. So always, when you buy a contract, you buy them for the lifetime, the anticipated lifetime of the array. If you're gonna keep an array for 5 years, if you say, hey, we're gonna swap out in 4 years, well, you know you got that 5th year that thing's gonna be sitting around while you're making the swap over, buy 5 years worth of support. That way, you can pay 5 years worth of cheap support rather than 3 years of cheap support and then 3 years paying through your teeth. It's really, really important to do that. So try to buy the right amount of each resource that you need. Are there any questions? Comments? Personal problems? Thank you very much.